Radio Free Iboria, Episode 2. I'm your host, Herman, straight from the Iborian Age with my barbarian buddy, Billy Delicious. How are you today, Billy?
I am fantastic. I'm here flexing my Iborian muscles and playing with my sword.
Your prodigious Iborian pecs. Amazing, Billy. No, yeah, this is definitely, I mean, Conan and Cole and the likes, they're kind of the guys who give me a inferiority complex because, damn, these guys are ripped. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, I'm sitting here with my quarantine weight looking very unbarbarian-like. I'm like one of those fat, civilized merchants you find in Namibia or someplace that Conan would rob when he finds them on the highways.
Yeah, I actually just watched Conan the Barbarian the other day. It was great.
Oh, man. John Milius, that movie is such a staple of my childhood. We got to talk about that down the line, right, Billy, Radio Free Iboria when we do a special edition. We can probably even put that on the main feed. Who knows? But, you know, that's such a great movie. As a kid, I must have rewatched that 100 times. Strangely enough, I don't know what you think. That is not really Conan the Barbarian for me, though. I mean, in terms of how I'm used to Conan from the comics and from the stories. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's much different. Yeah. It's not, you don't really see a lot of similarities between that and the Marvel comic, for sure.
Yeah, they've even got the Cull villain, Thulsa Doom, which we'll encounter down the line. They've got him as Conan's villain, played by, of course, the great James Earl Jones. So that movie is a seminal movie. It's a fantastic bit of sword and sorcery on film, and I'm always going to love it. But Arnold made the character his own. It's not really Conan, you know, from the books and stuff. But I really enjoy that movie. I even enjoy the second one, which many people pan as horrible. You know, I love the second one, the Conan the Destroyer, as well.
Yeah, it's a fun watch.
So, Billy, now we're going to be talking a lot of Conan and a lot of Cull again this week. Specifically, we're doing Conan the Barbarian, number 2, issue 2, from way back in December of 1970. Now, as we mentioned in our previous Conan discussion on Radio Free Iboria episode 1, Conan is considered by many to have kickstarted the Bronze Age of comic books. So this is now the second issue, also still early days. We've got Barry Windsor Smith still doing his Kirby here, but you can already see a little bit of his style changing, I would say. But he's still very firmly a Kirby disciple, and Roy Thomas already killing it on the writing, because this is an original tale which he had to come up with in the early issues of Conan, because, like we mentioned, he did not yet have the rights to the Conan stories that he could adapt, which later the Marvel would acquire those rights. But right now, Roy, soon. But right now, he had to come up with all original content, which is fine by me, because it's great, right? So, Billy, I'm going to introduce the rest of the, factoids about this issue, and then I'm going to leave it over to you. We're going to do our Twitter-style synopses again. All right, so like I mentioned, Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, Number 2, first published in December 1970. The writer, of course, Roy Thomas, the penciler, Barry Smith, now known to us as Barry Windsor Smith. He recently celebrated his birthday as well. Inked by Sal Buscema. Well. John Buscema's younger brother, Sal Buscema, one of my favorite Bronze Age artists. And colored by Mimi Gold, lettered by Sam Rosen, and edited by Stan Lee. Now, you kind of wonder how much editing Stan did, because at this point in time, he trusted Roy so much, you know. And also, Stan was not a fan of sword and sorcery at all. So I'm kind of thinking this might be in name only, but who knows? He might have looked over it, because this was early days. They were worried. They were concerned. Marvel had never published a title like this before, right, Billy?
Yeah, like you said, I think probably in name only. I don't know how much editing he was doing with Roy, because I think by now Roy had been there for maybe about 4 or 5 years, and he was really Stan's right-hand man, and he was basically getting ready to take over for Stan as Stan was going to move out of the editor's chair.
Yeah, that's right. He wasn't, I think this was just on the cusp of Stan getting ready to move to Hollywood, or to Los Angeles at least, to, champion Marvel's TV and film rights over there. But Yeah, you're right. He probably didn't do a lot of hands-on editing where Roy was concerned. Maybe with other people, but not with Roy, since Roy was his chosen successor, right, Billy? And well chosen. I have to admit, we all have to admit that. All right, so Billy, I'm going to let you go first with the synopsis for Conan the Barbarian issue 2. And we're doing it Twitter style again, so 140 characters. Oh, sorry, 280 characters these days, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And if we go a little bit over, or if we have a little bit less, that's fine. Or if we're a little bit under. So lay it on us, Billy.
Okay. After chasing a beautiful woman through the jungle, Conan gets ambushed and gets forced to fight in an arena. Hopefully, Hank McCoy gets word of this and tells his brethren, the Beast Men, to release Conan.
Damn, they do look like a lot of, you know, Hank McCoy's running around there, right? A lot of beasts. Yep. When he was still the gray beast. But I'm pretty sure I saw a couple of blue ones, you know, running over there as well. Oh, brilliant synopsis. Nice one, Billy. All right, mine says, here we go. It's Planet of the Apes meets the Hyborian Age as Conan is captured by the simian beastmen of Hyperborea. While forced to work as a slave in their sunless realm, he incites a rebellion and leads the pitiful pale humans to victory, but at the cost of a new friend's life. Yeah, so Billy, you made the, you know, connection to Beast. I made the connection to Planet of the Apes, which is a licensed property that'll pop up in Marvel soon enough. So look for the, by the way, look for that, listeners, on our House of Licensed Ideas episodes here on, you know, Into the Weird's Patreon, because we'll be talking about that, right, Billy?
Oh, yeah.
So let's get into the cover first, Billy. This cover, pretty interesting. You know, I don't actually own this issue. I'm reading it in the Chronicles of Conan, put out by Dark Horse, you know, probably 15 years ago by now, but they still look great, printed on sturdy paper. And they did not actually include the covers in those volumes, so I kind of had to look the cover up online. Yeah, and there's very few of the early Conan the Barbarian single issues that I own, you know. I own a lot of the later stuff. But so I looked up the cover up online, and, you know, of course, it's Barry Smith and Sam Rosen working in tandem on this cover. A lot of talking on this cover, a lot of speech bubbles. Just one, actually, but there's a lot of words in there from this beast man. Mm-hmm. Die, manling. You are no match for the power of the beast men. There's a hyphen. In the cavern waits doom. And there's a girl on the cover standing. Obviously, she's like some kind of a pet, right, to this beast man leader. And Conan's being accosted by these Kirby-esque, you know, beast men, I would say. I mean, Kirby would draw a lot of beast men during his time, but I can't really put my finger on where I've seen this kind of Kirby-like beast men before. Probably, I don't know, during his New Gods stuff at DC, he did, you know, the Hunger Dogs. These guys kind of look like, you know, the Hunger Dogs of the Apocalypse's slums, you know, near the fire pits over there. So, yeah, but the girl that's on the cover that points towards Conan imperiously, she's, you know, as we learn throughout the story, she's actually like a pet, you know, the favorite of this Beast King. But she looks very much like Valkyrie, right, Billy, from the Defenders.
Yeah, she does. I mean, I like the cover quite a bit, too. You know, you have Conan there struggling with these beast men as they're attacking him, and he's in his, fur mankini there, looking pretty tough with his helmet on there, too. And I do like how Barry Windsor-Smith, the one beast man that's kind of only halfway in the shot, he has his sword pointing at Conan, and it's got, you know, it's like a perspective shot. So, you know, the sword, you know, if you look at it, only looks like it's, you know, 6 inches long, but it's actually pointed towards him. So it's a pretty neat little idea there. So I do like what he did there. He did a good job with that. Yeah.
That's a good call there, Billy. Yeah, I did not notice that, but it's pretty excellent. Yeah. The sword for me, though, is a little bit thin. It's on the thin side. It's almost like a rapier or something. Meanwhile, we know that Conan wields a broadsword, which, you know, most often has to be wielded, you know, two-handed. But Conan, you know, normally swings it about with one hand.
The one he has in his hand, Conan, it almost reminds me of the kind of sword that, oh gosh, what's that other character that Conan's going to run into in like 10 or issues or so? Your buddy, Elric.
Oh, Elric, you mean Stormbringer. Oh yeah, that's
Yeah, it almost Elric's reminds sword. Me more of his sword.
Yeah, but you see, even that is strange because, you know, Stormbringer in the Michael Moorcock stories is supposed to be a massive sword. You know, almost that only a giant could wield. The only reason why the pale and sickly Elric can wield that sword one-handed sometimes, Billy, is because the sword imparts super strength to him. You know, when you touch the hilt. But, you're right. They drew it differently in the Conan series once Elric shows up. So we'll see some more licensed sword and sorcery characters here, you know, later on. I always wondered what would have happened if they happened upon Elric and not Conan, you know, Billy, as their main sword and sorcery character at Marvel. Because Elric is a pretty big deal, you know, too. And his books were arguably more popular at, you know, in the late 60s than the Conan books were. I'd say maybe neck and neck, but, you know, Elric's writer, Michael Moorcock, was still alive, you know, so he was still writing. So the potential for story there was greater. But I don't think the Elric license stayed with Marvel for long. You know.
No, not at all.
But we got some good Marvel graphic novels out of Elric. Ooh, some pretty good stuff. Maybe we'll talk about that too. That's not Hyborian Age, but hey, since Elric showed up in the Hyborian Age, you know, we might incorporate that, right, Billy?
it's he's tangentially involved there, so you can get away with it.
That's right. Now, Billy, what do you think about the opening splash page? I love this page.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, you have this beast man laying there dead that Conan just killed. And I love how Conan talks. The giant one is dead because he thought me too small, too puny to fight back. But what manner of man or brute is it that came charging toward me from out of nowhere? And, you know, like I say, he's laying there dead, and Conan's kind of like lurched over him a little bit. And he looks like he's at least twice the size of Conan. He looks huge. But yeah, great shot. This like winter scene in the forest. Oh, it looks great.
Yeah, apparently this was one of the scouts or one of the, you know, the guards of the pack of beastmen that's haunting this area of snowy Hyperborea, as this part of, you know, the Hyborian kingdoms are known. And, you know, Conan slew him. It doesn't look as if it was an easy battle, but, you know, this guy was twice the size of a normal beastman, like you mentioned, Billy. He's a giant, and they even comment on him later, you know, when they realize that it was Conan who slew this giant, because there's a girl, the girl that we mentioned from the cover, I presume, who has been spying on Conan as he killed this giant, apparently. So we sort of start the story in medias res, right, in the middle of the tale, after he killed this giant beastman. And then, you're right, this is Conan drawn still as he was in issue one, lithe, you know, lean, sinewy. You know, he's not the Conan that we'd get later once John Buscema climbs on the title, where he's more like the Conan described by Robert E. Howard in the Conan Weird Tales stories, because there Conan is very fast, pantherish, you know, but he's a giant, you know, you know, in terms of, you know, if you compare him to his fellow men, you know, he's a giant. But here, you know, Conan is very much dwarfed by his assailants. And I love the look where he's got the helmet with the two horns on it, right, Billy? That wouldn't last long, but what do you think about that look?
Yeah, I like that as well. And I think we were remiss in our very first Patreon episode in mentioning that there was a, like, proto-Conan character that did show up in Chamber of Darkness #4. There was no name, I don't think, but it was the exact replica of what would be Conan in the issue #1.
Here. Really? Chamber of Darkness #4?
Yeah, Roy Thomas and Barry Smith, The Sword and the Sorcerers, and there was a barbarian fighting sorcerers, and it looks exactly like Conan here in the first issue and first two issues here, yeah.
Dude, I think I own that issue here, but I can't even remember that, man. That's interesting, yeah. I got to check that out because, they
same
might have...
Same helmet and everything.
They yep, might have given him a trial run, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, we gotta talk about that because I would love
but
to.
But he's got that two-pronged helmet on, though. So that's what made me think of that. I was like, oh, yeah, that guy had that on, too.
Must be the same, right? Hey, interesting, yeah. So mm-hmm. they must have given it a bit yeah. of a trial run, like you say, which they also did with yeah. Cole. You know, we'll talk yep. about that later. But yeah, they gave him a short story in a title to see just if the readers would bite, right? To see if they would, you know, write in and say they like this character, which is mostly how the Marvel bullpen, or at least editorial, you know, try to suss out whether readers or not like this concept and whether they could keep it going, you know, other than the mm-hmm. sales, because the sales numbers would only come in much later, right? But sometimes even after the initial, you know, reader's response. So they relied mm-hmm. heavily on the readers. So you're right. They gave that a trial run, you know, the concept mm-hmm. of a barbarian character.
Yeah, and I mean, it's included in the, I'm reading this in the Epic Collection. And they actually put that in first right before Conan number one, too. So that was cool.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I don't even mm-hmm. own that Epic Collection. I don't think I'm ever going to buy even the Omnibuy or the Epic Collections because, like I said, I'm quite satisfied with the Dark Horse reprints of the Marvel material. But it's also, mm-hmm. it'll be a hefty investment, right, Billy, to go that route. I might do some of the Savage Sword of Conan Omnibuy once they get to the issues I don't have. You know, mm-hmm. but yeah, everything's being reprinted, which is we're lucky, right? We're in a bit of a golden age of reprints here.
mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as you get the stuff when it first comes out before it goes out of print, this is the time to get it right now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, things don't last a long time in print these days. Everybody's snapping it up. I'm thinking of the Master of Kung Fu Omnibuy, and even the Epic Collections. That's hard to get. Luckily, Conan's still out there, so we'll see how it goes. Billy, now, the girl that they draw in this issue, that Conan sees and pursues through the snowy forest, she's drawn very alluringly, as most mm-hmm. Hyborian girls are drawn and described, you know, they're all hot.
Yep.
But here, Conan is not quite the Conan from the stories. He does not, I mean, there's a story, The Frost Giant's Daughter, where Conan sees a girl in the snow, and he chases her down with, you know, amorous intention, you know, here, he's much more gallant. He's much more like a knight in shining armor kind of Conan, you know. Because it's comics, mm-hmm. You know, even though the comics book code was challenged at this time, they're not going to go that route.
No.
Yeah, but here he just wants directions. He just wants to know where he is. And he chases this girl down. And then he gets, you know, sort of cheap shot it, right, by this beast
man. Shanghai'd, yeah.
Yeah, he gets shanghai'd. And you know, he's then proving very, very resilient, very tough. He gets up. He wants to, you know, wreak his vengeance on this beast man. And the beast man's quite upset, too, because his choicest pike had been snapped on Conan's muscular torso while he shanghaied him, right? And we learn that this beast man's name is Zagor. You know, he's like the chief of the beast men, at least the captain of the beast men. So they knock mm-hmm. him out, right, Billy? And then we get this fantastic scene where they take him underground mm-hmm. as a slave because they've been capturing human slaves for centuries. And I don't even think they've bothered to capture any new slaves until, you know, Conan, because the slaves have been breeding down there, right? So the human slaves in this cavern, these caverns below the world, they're lightless caverns, so they're all pale and pitiful and worm-like, as they're described by the Beastmen. These humans have been their slave race. But this is still, you know, for me, this is where Barry Windsor-Smith deviates from Kirby. He might have had the Kirby characters, but he didn't have the Kirby architecture and technology. Kind of, you know, mm-hmm. down the way Kirby drew it, right, Billy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it almost reminds me more of like a Trimpy kind of style or something.
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's kind of like the Marvel House style for drawing, mm-hmm. you know, ancient kingdoms and things like that. But, you know, when you mm-hmm. put Kirby on that, you get Asgard. You know, when you put, you know, Barry Smith on this here, you just get the normal, like you say, the Herb Trimpy, the Hulk in a different civilization kind of style, you know. So Conan is upset, you know. He doesn't like to be captured. At first, Zagor sort of hefts him above his head and just hurls him into this chamber filled with humans. And then Conan gets the lowdown here from a guy called Kiord, right? He's sort of the the leader of these slave humans. He's a giant himself, right, Billy? He's huge. Oh, yeah. And it turns
he's
out that...
He's probably like 7 feet tall.
Yeah, he's much taller than Conan. But he's more sedate, more, you know, used to the life here. He's accepting of his fate and of the fate of his race. You know, he has no intention to escape. Conan sort of changes that, you know, as the course of the issue progresses, right? But at first, you've got Conan here, you know, railing, and he's going mad because this is the first time that he's ever been chained, you know, that he's ever been made a slave, right, Billy?
Yeah.
So as we, you know, if you talked about the movie earlier, there in the movie, the origin is decidedly different. You know, he was, you know, enslaved when he was a child, but... He spent years and years in slavery as a, you know, first a mill grinder and then later, you know, as gladiator. But here it's more like his slavery is very brief. Now, Billy, I want you to speak about the history of these beast men and the people who encountered them. This is very, very interesting. It's almost as if the beast men are sort of very intelligent apes, and their encounter with humans... Rather than the humans vanquishing them, they vanquished the humans, but they didn't kill all of them. They kept them and learned, you know, like how to forge and build, and they learned architecture from the humans. And these beast men, you know, very intelligent, but not intelligent enough to develop their own civilization without the help of slaves who could help them to build it. That's basically the concept here.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay...
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird...
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator... We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, and it's funny too. You know, you see them kind of defeat the humans and say, okay, well... You know, we learned how to use weapons because of the humans, and there's one of the beastmen holding a sword by the blade. And then, like you said, it shows, you know, the beastmen kind of forcing them into labor and showing them how to build and things like that. And then they're like, wait a minute. All these men that we have captured here are dying out. So I guess the human males told the beastmen about... making whoopee, and that's how you reproduce. So then they went back to a village and stole some females to breed with the men to make more slaves so they could just keep having slaves and slaves and slaves and never run out.
Exactly. Oh man, that part's funny. It seems that, you know, every single woman captured was a lovely bride for the hapless man slaves, as they put them.
Welcome to comics in the Bronze Age. There were never any ugly women, and it was just every other guy was as ugly as sin.
Lots of cheesecake.
But the women were always beautiful.
Yeah, exactly, man. Hey, you gotta attract those young, you know, teenage nerds.
Male readers,
yeah. Horny as hell, but also loving their Conan stuff, but in it for the girls. I mean, obviously we'll see that side of Conan later on, you know, as Roy progresses, you know, through the Conan tales. There we'll see Conan become more amorous, you know, Billy. He'll have more girlfriends.
Oh, yeah.
He'll do his James Bond thing where basically every female ends up being his... you know, bedmate sooner or later. Mm-hmm. But here he's very different. You know, he's a young Conan, very gallant, but, you know, not really in it for the girls. He's more in it for, you know, just the adventure and the experience. So I think it also had something to do with the code, Roy going that way, right, Billy? Because you don't see any other Marvel characters sleeping with just every single girl around. Conan's definitely going to go that way during the comic very soon. I'd say within the first 20 issues...
Yeah, like you said, once the code started relax a little. I think that's when they started to get a little more adventurous with that kind of stuff. But yeah, oh my gosh, so this the dialogue in here is great. I love it. One of the beast men takes Conan's helmet off and says, "Ha, this war helm is not for the likes of a slave. I claim it for my prize. What say you to that, dog?" Conan just starts beating the crap out of the guy and choking him with his chains.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's funny. Ho there, dog. Oh, man, it's great. And I love it when the Beastmen leader sort of tells them to, you know, it's the work day, you know, dawning. He says, "It is the work time. Chief Thrall, muster your manlings." And then they're pushing these giant Kirby machines around, right, Billy, which is these wheeled affairs for construction purposes, presumably. But Conan, like you say, he rebels because someone stole his favorite helm. And then the Beastmen are more than ready to kill him. I mean, they're kicking him around like a soccer ball, right, at one point in time. Oh, yeah. And then Kjord and the humans, they just turn a blind eye. But then, you know, the Beastman leader, his supremacy, right? I don't know exactly if they ever name him, but they just call him the Supreme Beastman, right? His supremacy. He shows up and he sort of, he steps in and he says, "This manling's different than the rest, you know, he's more fiery. What should we do with him?" And then the girl, the pet of this leader, she says, "May I suggest, sire, the games?" So now we're getting Conan and some gladiatorial bouts here, which is always great. So Conan is reserved for that. But luckily Kjord, you know, starts to prove his worth here, right? Kjord, during, you know, Conan's going to fight in the arena. Kjord knows he's going to die, but he's going to help Conan out. So he gives Conan a type of chiseled knife or chiseled dagger that he's been working on, right, Billy? A knife of obsidian.
A shiv.
Yeah, a shiv. It's a shiv because this is the prison, right? So, yeah, it's a shiv. He gives Conan a shiv. And he says he's been carving it, but he gave up on, you know, a life of freedom long ago. But maybe Conan can make use of it. But, you know, during this exchange between Conan and Kjord, it turns out that Conan has influenced Kjord somewhat with his rebellious spirit. You know, Kjord's thinking about rebelling himself. Now, Billy, this is not your typical gladiatorial bout. This is sort of the beast men pitting beasts against men. You know, so what does Conan fight in this arena?
A white lion. Completely white, head to toe, everything.
Yeah, a snow lion. That's how they describe it, yeah. And Conan, you know, this is an epic battle because this is Conan's first sighting of a lion. He's only heard about these beasts, you know. This is a mythical creature for him, you know, since he saw none of them in Sumeria, where he grew up as a lad. But he, you know, he's very Tarzan-like here. Conan takes the lion out with a lot of flair. He shivs him, right? Prison style. Shivs this lion. And this is interesting. After he stabs the lion to death, the dialogue goes like this, the caption. It says, "And then from despair, triumph, from defeat, victory, and from out the jaws of death, life." That's Roy. That's Roy for you. So Conan survived. Yeah. But, you know, the chief of the Beastmen, his supremacy, he's not too happy with his victory. He says, you know, he shall die slowly, you know, because he had a weapon. He cheated, guardsmen. You know, so the guards are going to, well, they're going to net Conan and then kill him. But Conan gets a punch in, right? He slugs one of these guardsmen on the jaw. And then, you know, death. But then, you know, Kjord shows his strength. What does he do, Billy?
He, like, because they have the other humans like penned up there that they can see what's going on. Like there's like a, almost like a cage or cell or something. And there's a wooden door and he smashes right through the wooden door and clobbers one of the beastmen with the door. Cause he's, like you said, Conan is kind of like a little bit of a fire inside him that, hey, you know, maybe we don't have to live here and be slaves the rest of our lives. Maybe, you know, we can get out of here. So he goes and berserk, and all the other humans come out too, like, they're going to just have a full-on, like, prison riot here, attic.
That's exactly what happens, man. Yeah, Conan, you know, he steals a sword from one of the beastmen after Kjord, you know, joins the fray, and all the humans do too. But you're never sure. You know, some of them might be willing to fight, but a lot of them just fleeing. You know, the humans that have been set free by Kjord. And Conan slashes a beast man. You see the beast man dying off panel, but still, you know, you definitely get the impression that he's just cut this guy in twain, or this beast man. But then, Billy, something unreal happens. Kjord shows, well, his superhuman strength. Now, we know Conan's also inhumanly strong in most, you know, cases. But Kjord, wow, this guy's nobody to mess with, I'd say. He sort of single-handedly, and then eventually with the help of Conan, starts pushing this giant battering ram towards the elevated pavilion or platform that the Beastmen royalty is on. And Conan helps him. It's this giant ram, right? This battering ram, this siege weapon. Yeah. And they end up pushing it at such speed that it runs towards this platform with the section of the arena where, you know, the Beastmen royalty are on. And you've got the king screaming for his life, "No, no!" You know, as this giant siege weapon approaches him, it smashes into the arena and collapses that part of the arena so that all the Beastmen royalty and the traitorous pet human girl, they're all crushed beneath hundreds of tons of masonry, right, Billy? And then, unfortunately, just as, you know, the humans have gained their freedom, what happens to Kjord?
Well, one of the beast men didn't quite get killed, so as Kjord is celebrating and Conan's getting his helmet from the beast man that took his helmet, the one beast man that's still kicking, slashes Kjord from behind and kills him. And then Conan goes berserk and he kills him. It's that Zagor guy, and he says, "I pray you have a soul, Zagor, that it may drift and mutter forever in some beast man's hell." He kills him, and then there's a really nice moment here at the end. You know, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, basically earlier when we first met his supremacy, you know, the leader, the king of the beast men, he was sporting this crown, and he sort of bragged about the crown to Conan as he was sort of half strangling Conan there, where he said that this crown that he wears is made from the tusks of the long-dead tusk bears that roamed the snows of Hyperborea, right? And this crown is very interesting. It's sort of like, you know, a manacle set around your neck, but then these tusks grow, you know, attached to the side of this manacle, grows up, you know, past your ears and up to where it, you know, terminates in a point above your head. So it's a very, very distinctive-looking crown. Also, these tusks seem to be, you know, laden with jewels or whatnot, right? So this crown that the Beast King had been sporting is his sign of office. And, you know, when Kjord dies, Conan, he pushes his way through the mob of onlookers and searches through the wreckage where the dead Beastmen lie, crushed. And then he finds this crown of the Beast King, and he puts it on Kjord's head as Kjord lies there in death. And then he says, "Yes, thralls, you are free now, and long may you remain so, but let your legends say of this day that a king led you to victory, and that his name was Kjord." So he sort of crowns Kjord the king of the Hyperborean humans in death. And then he ends by saying he was the last of the manlings, but first among men. So he sort of insults the rest of the crowd there, justifiably so, right, Billy? Because they were pathetic weaklings, but Kjord was the best among them. It's true, but so a very fitting end, but also very touching, like you said. And that's how we wrap up this issue with Conan crowning one of his very first friends. Well, he had a friend in issue one, right, who died as well, but. You know, Conan would make some battle buddies throughout his career, and most of them would die.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's a note going forward. Don't hang out with Conan unless you're a woman. Because if you're a guy, you're probably going to die.
Oh, yeah, the woman will survive 90% of the time, I'd say. But the guys, yeah. No. Yeah, there will be some exceptions, you know, like Zula and some other guys later on. But, you know, yeah, you're right, Billy, man. Hanging around with Conan is like being a red shirt in a Star Trek, you know, crew.
Yeah. Yeah, you're in trouble.
Oh, man, this was a great... great issue, Billy. So final thoughts on this issue. I don't have much to say other than I love Barry Smith's art, even though it was heavily Kirby influenced. I don't mind this period of Barry Smith at all. I'm in love with his art. And the story itself was great. You know, it's like a classic sword and sorcery tale of capture, enslavement, you know, rebellion, and even some gladiatorial, you know, combat thrown in there against the lion, but still, it's in a gladiatorial arena. And then a very, you know, heartfelt moment at the end there, where Conan honors a fallen comrade. So, you know, Billy, I love this issue. What would you say about this particular tale?
Yeah, it's a good one, for sure. Like you said, he's not yet adapting anything from Howard, so this is all, you know, all Roy. So I really liked it and thought he did a great job, you know, so kudos to him. It was pretty good story from start to finish, and like you said too, the artwork is great. A couple of Kirby-esque things about it, you know, but that's not a bad thing either. Like you said, even back then when Barry Windsor-Smith was first starting out, he was, you know, a Kirby clone. Big fan of Kirby stuff. Yeah, it's a Kirby clone, but he did pretty good in this issue. You can see he's starting to, you know, slowly turn towards his, you know, his own style, but still have that Kirby, heavy Kirby influence there. But yeah, look great.
That's right, man. So Billy, we'll move on to our next property here, which is of course one of our favorites of the Bronze Age, Call the Conqueror, issue 2. And this time around I do have a cover, because for some reason in the Chronicles of Kull volume 1, which I also bought off of Dark Horse about 20 years ago by now, you know, they did include the Kull covers, but they did not include the Conan covers in the Conan collection. So still, you know, we'll talk about that when we get to it. This is your issue. You're going to be introducing the specs here, and I'll go first with the synopsis. So, Billy, give us the lowdown on Kull issue 2.
Yeah, so Kull 2 from 1971. This, again, a Roy Thomas writer. But Marie and John Severin artists, which is fantastic. And then Sam Rosen on letters, and adapted from the story by Robert E. Howard is what you get here also. So, yep, fantastic stuff here.
Yeah, man, this is a great issue and a great cover. And like you say, you got two legends, you know, doing most of the penciling duties here. John and Marie Severin from EC Comics fame, and from the, you know, the golden age of comics, and the tail end of the golden age of comics. I think readers must have, well, I don't know if they knew what they had back then, but Marvel must have thought they lucked out getting these two on the title, even though Kull didn't do that well. You know, I think it's basically Conan's fault, you know, the popularity of Conan and Kull being too similar, you know, to Conan might have affected sales. But damn, the art was incredible, and Roy's writing as well, right, Billy? This is Roy doing most of the writing duties, and it's a fantastic story, but this is much more closer to the Howard source material, so I don't think this is completely original, you know, Billy. This is definitely in line with what some of the Kull short stories that Howard wrote for Weird Tales, which some were never published, you know, some were just rejected, but this dealt heavily with the threat that we'll find in this issue, which is the Serpent Men.
Kull's, yeah, I love this. Yeah. Love this cover, man. Love it.
It's a fantastic cover.
It gives it. Yeah, the cover kind of gives it away, but it's still awesome. I love it.
Yeah, dude. I mean, this is some pretty fantastic Bronze Age stuff here. So, Billy, can you give us some more specs on this issue, and then I'll go with the synopsis first this time around.
Yeah, oh, yeah, like I said, Kull 2, 1971, but yeah, it's called The Shadow Kingdom, and like you said, it involves the Serpent Men, so, you know, on the cover, it's interesting how the Serpent Men have a serpent head and neck, but then the whole rest of their body is human. I think that's hilarious. I love it.
That's pretty damn good. Yeah, I like that effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Billy, I'm going to go then with my synopsis here. Okay, so this story is, in fact, adapted from original Robert E. Howard material. In fact, The Shadow Kingdom was a story that Robert E. Howard wrote. Mm-hmm. But there's been some changes here and there. I did not put this in my synopsis, though. I don't want to spoil anything until we talk about the issue itself. So here goes. Cull meets with the Picts, and after some macho banter, learns that the Serpent Men have infiltrated his kingdom. In the company of the Pictish warrior Brule, he roots the monsters out with the help of the phrase Kanama Kajerama. After copious amounts of bloodshed, Cull prevails. So roughly what happened. There's some more stuff, you know, but how much could you really fit into a Twitter synopsis? Billy, what about yours?
Okay, so I've got swords, strippers, and serpent men. Cull must face all three. Spoiler alert, he can't handle the stripper.
Damn, yes, he can handle that stripper. Oh, that's a good one, man. That's really good. So, Billy, yeah, let's talk some more about the cover. I think you're right. That effect of the serpents attacking, but they're half human, just with these giant serpent-like heads. They basically look like walking anacondas. You know, and Cull hefting one of them above his head, ready to hurl him at the mass. And then you've got Brule, well, slaying someone that's true to his name, right? Brule, the slayer. He's impaling one there. And then we've got, already a heap of dead lying at Cull's feet. This is a fantastic cover, obviously because of John and Marie Severin's fantastic skills, but also just the main concept behind the cover is great. It's this in the heat of battle, and shows how powerful Cull really is.
Yeah.
So no, I love this cover, man. You can't go wrong with this one. And you know, it also says this is still early days, so they're trying to piggyback off of the fame of Conan here, because the cover has the tagline, "New from the creator of Conan, Cull the Conqueror." You know, it's interesting, you know, a kingdom of shadows, you know, so they took the Shadow Kingdom and changed the title on the front to the Kingdom of Shadows. I love it. It's a great cover.
Yeah, the only nitpick I would have is it has, you know, Cull in like basically a diaper.
Oh, yeah. It looks like some goat skin diaper. Yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, it's great. The corner box is awesome. It's Cull holding a sword over his head like he just, you know, chopped somebody's head off. He's like, you know, celebrating somebody he just slew, and he's got a cape and, you know, all this crazy other garb on. But yeah, the rest of the cover, awesome. I love how, like, on the regular, do you have the regular issue, or do you have this in a trade, you said?
No, I also have this in the Dark Horse Collected. I don't even own the regular issue. Yeah, I have this in the Dark Horse Collected Edition. Yeah.
Yeah, so on the original issue, these serpent men are hilarious. There's one of them. The head is like golden. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other ones are green, or 6 other ones are green. And then there's one, the one that Brule is killing, looks like he has an orange head. So whoa. I don't know if there's like a, what the difference is between these serpent men with the different colored heads, but I think that's hilarious. But yeah, and then there's my favorite serpent man is, or serpent man, is the guy that's on the ground right like behind Cull. Well, there's two of them, and one has a sword that he's looking like he's going to run right through Cull, and then the other one has a sword in his right hand, and he's kind of slouching down as if he's hurt, but with his left hand, he's grabbing Cull's sword. Now, don't get dirty here, just his metal sword with his left hand, and yeah, so that's hilarious. I'm like, what is going on here? I like that guy on the ground.
That is weird. I think in the reprints in the Chronicles of Cull, you know, that I'm reading, they were fairly consistent with the colors. Everybody's green except for the snake man in the foreground, who's golden, you know.
Yeah.
So he's got a golden U. But, you know, the rest of them are pretty consistent. Yeah, I had to mention that actually earlier, Billy, but I just declined to do so. But I might, you know, mention that now. Even in the Conan issue we discussed, the white snow lion was drawn like a regular lion in the reprint, you know, the reprinted coloring. It was just a yellow lion or brownish. So, you know, but obviously it had to be white. I mean, you won't survive long if you're a yellow lion, you know, where's your camouflage, you know, in the snowy wastes. But yeah, there's some significant coloring differences between the original issues and the Dark Horse reprinted material. For the most part, it was done well, you know, but there are some you know, I would say mistakes on the part of the recoloring. Still,
What about the splash page here? What do you think of that? That's pretty awesome.
Okay, the splash is amazing. I don't love this as much as the Conan splash page, but I should love it more because, wow, what's happening here, Billy? It's got this Pictish maiden dancing, this almost like a mating dance in front of Kull, because Kull is visiting the Picts. As we learned in the previous issue, Brule showed up in Volusia asking Kull for a meet, for a sit-down with the Pictish chief Kanu. Now, Kanu is—he's a wizened old man. He's not like a Pictish chieftain that you would expect, like a warrior. I mean, he used to be a warrior, of course, but now he's very much, you know, basically just a king, but in his old age. And he's, on this splash page, they've got sort of at the top they've got Volusia in the background, the City of Wonders, and then they've got this encampment of the Picts, who's very much a tribal kind of folk, you know, hearkening back to maybe, you know, Native Americans. But of course, this is in the, you know, Pictish Isles. So, you know, they're more like Celtic people, you know, they're the ancient Celts, you know, were also called the Picts, right, Billy? So that's at least where Howard took this from when he wrote this into his stories. But these Picts are very much like, you know, Maoris or, you know, maybe the South Pacific Islanders, you know, those kind of folk. They're also drawn to be quite red-skinned, which is, you know, unfortunate. But, you know, this girl is beautiful, you know, and she's got all this fur on her, you know, furry bikini. She's got these beads or necklaces shaking around. She's holding two spears, so she's a warrior maiden. And then Kanu asks, "Well, Kull, what do you think of our Pictish entertainments?" And what does Kull say, Billy?
"They are very entertaining." But his face, though, his face, he's just looking like he couldn't care less. Like, he doesn't know what to do. I don't know if he has stage fright or what.
Yeah, Kull's not, you know, like Conan at all. He's not, he doesn't have a huge libido. He's never in it for the ladies, unfortunately. That's an unfortunate part about Kull, I would say, is that he's totally indifferent towards, you know, this side of life. But you know, we see the girls quite liking Kull, you know, in most you know, the Kull comics where there's a girl, they're always throwing themselves at Kull, you know, like for instance in the next page, Billy, you've got Kanu, you know, asking the servant girl, well, the servant girl comes around to fill up, you know, Kanu's flagon or whatever he's drinking there with wine. And she's looking at Kull like, "Hey, you know, I'm going to visit your tent later tonight, secretly, king," you know. And then Kanu seems to be more, you know, he's got a huge, you know, sex drive for an old man, because he grabs this girl and he says, you know, what does he say? "You're thinking Kanu is a useless old fool, fit only to guzzle wine and kiss wenches. Well, we shall see." So that means he's more than that, but he does engage in that kind of activities frequently.
Yeah, I mean, maybe back in the pre-cataclysmic age, they already had Viagra or something.
You're right, man.
Fart.
This old guy, man, he's great. So then he banishes the rest of the Picts, the entertainment's over, and now it's time to talk business, right, Billy? Because first he quaffs his, you know, drink, he quaffs his flagon, and then he shows it to Kull. And you know, Kull wants to get, you know, down to the nitty-gritty as well. He wants to know why he's been summoned here by Kanu. And then Kanu, he shows Kull the bottom of this flagon that he's just drained. It's got this green jewel, a stolen gem from the Temple of the Serpent. So Kull recognizes this jewel. Apparently it was stolen like a long time ago. And then he sort of blames Kanu. He says, how did you, this is the Temple of the Serpent from Volusia. How did you, you know, happen upon this gem? And the world will rock with war if the priests learn that a Pict stole it. Mm-hmm. But you know this method behind old Kanu's madness, right, Billy? Because he says, "No, you know, Carl, you can betray me later if you feel you must." But listen, and then we get a bit of a rundown here on pre cataclysmic age, you know, lore, right, Billy? This is like before humankind. The Earth was ruled by basically demons, the wolf people, the harpies. And then, of course, the serpent men. So it was sort of like, you know, these four races of monsters, right? If you could call them that. The demons, the serpent men, the harpies, and the wolf people. Now, the wolf people look very much like the beast men, you know, that Conan fought. They don't really look wolf-like. They look more ape-like to me, at least. But this is a great bit of art here from the Severance, right, Billy? Speak on that. This one panel flashbacks the entire prehistory of the world.
Well, yeah, even that panel where he says about, you know, Kull, men were not always ruled by men, and the next panel shows, like you said, demons, harpies, the wolf people, and serpent men. Yeah. That's a really wild panel there, but it's a really cool page because they... This one page tells, like, basically a whole story, which is really cool. You know what I mean? And it shows, like, how the... I don't know if you want to call them barbarian men or whatever. Like, probably, like, the first people fighting against these, you know, creatures to try to, you know, gain supremacy, I guess. And it says, last to fall were the snake people. Yet, finally, even they were driven into the wastelands and left to die. But, you know, they didn't. They took on human guise and returned as priests of a new serpent cult. And, you know, as we go through Kull, you'll see how they managed to do that. There's somebody pretty powerful, you know, behind them that's their leader to help them kind of attain this subterfuge and this, like, you know, almost like shape-changing ability.
Yeah, now, you're right. They have this shape-changing power, or maybe it's a power to cast illusions over their true form. We don't know, but you're right, Billy. They're very much magic-based foes. And it seems that this war between the ancient humans and these four monster races, you know, the humans, I don't know how they won, because it seems that the only thing they had were these Stone Age weapons,
clubs,
right?
Clubs
and stuff. Yeah. But they won, and they killed the demons. Well, they exterminated the demons. It was genocide. The harpies and the wolf people, but you know, the snake people were the last, and they somehow survived, like you say, through disguising themselves as humans, as human priests. Now it seems that the serpent cult, the religion, is an accepted sort of religion by most people of the pre-cataclysmic age, right, Billy? The only revelation now that, you know, Kull learns from Kanu and from Brühl is that the priests of the serpent cult are in fact the actual serpent men who want to again dominate the world and enslave humanity. So Kanu and Brühl, they're you know, privy to this information, and now they want Kull to be their ally in their battle against the serpent men. So this is great. This is very similar to the Robert E. Howard tale, The Shadow Kingdom. And now, you know, you've got Kull and Brühl heading back to Volusia because Kull has learned from Kanu that the serpent men have infiltrated, you know, all, not just, you know, the what do you call it, the temples of the serpent, but also, you know, his court, you know, so there are serpent,
Volusia.
And now it gets crazy, right, Billy, because as Brühl and Kull walk through these halls surrounded by the Red Guard, who guard, you know, Kull's chambers, you know, Brühl knows, the Red Slayers, Brühl knows the palace better than Kull, because he presses, you know, a section of the wall, and a secret passage reveals itself. And then they happen upon Kull's Red Slayers, all dead, but yet they just passed some Red Slayers in the hall earlier. So these Red Slayers were killed, and then they were hidden here in the secret passage by whoever had killed them. And then Brühl showed him the actual Red Slayers. So Kull is, he's flabbergasted here, but Brühl explains that no, you know, in fact, there are many of these secret passages, and this is just one. Those Red Slayers out there might not be the actual Red Slayers. And Billy, then they see another person skulking through these hidden passages. What's happening here? You want to speak on this? This is insane.
Yeah, Call says, "To my chief counselor by night and with a bare dagger, but why?" And Brul says, "I think I know, because he's figured it out already that, you know, like he was told these serpent men have infiltrated, you know, even the Kull's kingdom. But, you know, like you said, if they can either shape change or cast an illusion that they just look like regular men, like how would you know?"
So yeah.
Kull then goes to sleep, and then somebody tries to come in and kill him.
Yeah, man, this is a great bit. I mean, I love the way that the Severance. Setup. Yeah, this is a great setup. The Severance draw this two, you know, in a very EC-like fashion. He looks like one of those murderers from the old EC horror comics, you know. And then you've got culprit feigning sleep and two approaching him, and then just as you know, he wants to slit Kull's throat or you know stab him with his dagger. Kull screams, "Fall, traitor!" And he sort of slashes him with his blade, and Two dies. Arr! Kull is very verbal during his battles. You know, where Conan will call on Krom, Kull will just tell you what's going to happen to you and then make it happen. And then we've got this great three-panel transformation scene where Two in death transforms back to his true form, which is the serpent man, right, Billy? But this looks like acid melting his face off, revealing the scales of the serpent man with this tongue, this dead tongue lolling out of the serpent man's mouth. It's some fantastic art. What would you say?
Mm-hmm. I love it. Yeah, that's, like you said, that three-panel sequence of him laying there and then like almost like some kind of acidic type thing. Like, yeah, like it's like his flesh is almost like burning or boiling away. And as the flesh boils or burns away, then you see, like you said, the scales and the serpent.
Yeah. And apparently, you know, this happened a long time ago, something similar. A king of Volusia was killed in battle, only to be revealed to be a serpent man in death. Right, Billy? So this is a sort of fear, the serpent man. But this is just a legend. It's a myth, you know, that perpetrated by probably some, you know, superstitious Volusian nobles. And because of that, you've got, you know, a legend permeating the kingdom. But nobody really believes it. But now Kull's about to show his entire court that this is true. And then Kull muses on his throne as Brul disposes of the body. And then just as Brul returns, he hurls a spear, right? And it turns out that Brul tried to kill Kull. Now, Kull's more than ready to pick up the fight with Brul because, after all, Billy, Brul challenged him, right, to a man-to-man, you know, encounter after some smack-talking in the previous issue to a fight, right? So now Kull, he's more than ready to throw down with Brul. He kills him with a sword, and then it's revealed that this Brul was, in fact, also a serpent man. And that's a bit of some great action panels there, right, Billy? Brul dies, but it's sort of off panel because Kull's body blocks the death, but it's a brutal kill, I think. And then you've got the real Brul showing up. All right, so Kull sort of tests him, right, Billy? Well, not really. It's Brul providing the means of the test, because Kull he holds his sword at Brul's throat, and then Brul says, I've got a way to resolve this, you know, uncertainty, King Kull. No serpent man can voice the phrase Kanama Ka Lajerama. Which is this mystical phrase, right, Billy, that apparently a serpent man cannot say. And Brul, you know, he does in fact say that. So Kull just believes him. He takes him at, you know, by his word. And he says, All right, I'll play along with you. So maybe this phrase works, maybe it doesn't, but you dispose of this second body as well. I mean, you already had to take care of the first. And they just hide them behind a curtain, right, Billy? Now, this part is crazy. As they're walking through the halls, something approaches. Now, what's happening here?
Yeah, it's funny. It basically looks like a ghost, like a ghost with a sword, like an old king or something like that. And, you know, there's some really good caption boxes here. And it says, "Through the stone gray passage it comes, a shape like unto a man, but misty and elusive, growing more tangible as it draws nearer, yet never wholly solid." So it's kind of like a ghost, but it looks like an old king coming to basically talk to the two of them, it seems.
Yeah, it seems that this is interesting for me, Billy. Like, if you're slain by a serpent man, then, and this in fact is the king from the legend, right? The one that was slain in battle and turned out to be a serpent man. This is presumably the human king who was killed by that serpent man who replaced him. If you're slain by a serpent man, you are doomed to be their slave in the afterlife as a ghost, you know? So that's very disturbing, but also a very interesting twist to this whole, you know, tale here. And then, you know, Brühl and Kull, they make a pact, because now that this has been revealed, they say that if I am slain, or if a serpent man is about to slay me, this is what Kull says, right? Then Brühl, you must kill me first, so that I never have to serve them in death. And then Brühl says, and you do the same by me. So they swear on their swords. It's a death pact, right, Billy? It's a death pact. They will kill each other before a serpent man kills them, so that they don't have to be their ghost slaves.
They're basically blood brothers now.
Yeah, they're blood brothers. And, you know, this is kind of one of the great buddy teams. Well, not in comics, I should say, but my favorite, because Brühl is always at Kull's side. He's one of Kull's entourage, but he's also his best friend. And he's his most faithful companion. I mean, you think about Sherlock Holmes and Watson. You know, you think about Buck Rogers and Tweaky. No, that's a bad analogy. You know, basically, this is, you know, Kull's faithful hanger-on. Now, Conan almost never had that, right, Billy? He would briefly have some companions, but like you said, they would either die or be replaced by new companions, or Conan would just solo. But Kull very much, most of the time, was accompanied by the faithful Brühl, who's a warrior on par with Kull, actually. You know, he's the greatest of the Picts, and that puts him on Kull's level, you know, I would say. You know, even though Kull, of course...
Starsky and Hutch.
Okay, good, better analogy. Yeah, better analogy for our American listeners out there. Oh, man, there's some great stuff to come, you know, down the line. I can't wait to talk about the rest of the issues in this series, but we'll have to bide our time, right, Billy? But, you know, Kull then, he decides to weed out the rest, and he meets up with the Red Slayers, and, you know, they say the phrase... Kanama Kalajerama, you know, as Kull commands them to. So it proves that they're human. And then he sits on his throne and he calls an assembly of his court. And then, you know, they all convene in his throne room, the council chamber, I should say, where the affairs of state are settled. And then, you know, Kull says, most gifted minds of Illusia, I've summoned you here to speak these words. Kanama, Kalajerama, and he screams it at them. And then the entire council council chamber, the group of counselors, they approach with murder in their eyes. All of them are serpent men. So, wow, this infiltration of Illusia has gone quite deep, right, Billy? And then you've got Kull and Brühl, the two of them, versus at least 20, a score, right, of serpent men. What would you say, Billy?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And, you know...
Oh, yeah, yeah, the whole throne room,
yeah. Yeah, Brühl hurls his spear. You know, he's the first one to take out a serpent man. He impales this guy on his spear. And then Kull slashes this guy across the chest. Now, Billy, the sound effect there is... This is the serpent man. You know, his death cry. Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, Billy,
and you can see some of them turning into lizards, like... Serpent men, as Kull and Brühl are going to town here. Some of them still look a little bit human, and some of them have just gone full on back to being like serpent men with their tongues hissing and sticking out and these fangs and everything. But oh, yeah, it's great. They start just slashing every one of them.
It's amazing, man. You've got this great, this bloody fight montage, and you know, with them just taking out the serpent men, and now you can see how powerful Brühl and Kull truly are. But you know, the thing we have to remember, Billy, is even Brühl comments on this, the fact that they made it through a horde of serpent men slaughtering all of them is mostly because these serpent men were counselors, priests. They were not really trained as warriors in battle, right? So that's basically the reason. So that makes it a little bit more believable, if you can call half men, half serpent folk believable at all. But then, you know, they rush towards, because this all happened in the council chamber, right? So they rush towards the throne room because they hear a familiar voice. And in fact, the voice they hear is Cole's own voice, you know? So, but something happened before. I mean, they thought they were in the council chamber, but it seems that the serpent men, that's why I'm thinking they can cast illusions rather than shape change, you know, because they've blanketed this council chamber with an illusion. It was, in fact, not a council chamber. It was a secret passage, one of the many secret passages in the castle. And then, you know, once the serpent men have all died, their illusion fades. And that's when Cole realizes they've been led into a trap, and they need to get to the bottom of this. So they rush to the real throne room. And then Cole kicks open the door. Now, this is funny, right, Billy? His real, you know, council members, or some of the council members who are still human, they're in there in the throne room. And when Cole kicks open the door, they say, it's our king. He must be the real king. Who else could have smashed through a bolted door? And then the other says, but if so, then who speaks from the dais? So now you've got... Well, I want you to talk about the next page. You've got Cole squaring off against the imposter. Who is he himself? This is one of the serpent men who have taken the guise of the king of Cole. And you've got this great panel where Cole confronts him. What do you see on that page?
Oh, it's awesome because, you know, as you know, you and I have talked about before, Cole's, you know, totem, if you want to call it that, is the tiger, because according to him, there is no mightier animal. And obviously these serpent men are serpents underneath these human guises. You have the two culls facing off, and in the background you have a tiger and a serpent, you know, a snake there, kind of like going head to head too. It's really, really good panel.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love it when the tiger totem or the tiger spirit appears whenever Cole's ready to get it, you know, to really throw down in battle. And the snake totem appears behind, like you say, this imposter Cole. But he doesn't last long. Two or three sword thrusts and Cole gets the better of him. But this is some great trash talking from Cole here. He says, first the snake man says, you shall die like unto a dog. You know, but first he calls him a swine too, right, Billy? What does he say? You speak like a very madman. Swine. He also calls him like a base pretender. And then Cole, he gets the last word and the last thrust in when he says, you speak thus, imposter, because you think that I'm wounded unto death, yet it takes but one wound to die, if 'tis the right one. And he just impales him. But that's not all, Billy. Yeah. He hefts him above his head. You know, this dead serpent man with his, like, snake head lolling. And he says, Kanama la Kajerama, right? Do you believe now that I am Cole, Lord of the Seven Empires? And then the people are just swept up by this epic scene. They're saying, all hell, Cole, death to the foes of Aluja. And then Cole reveals the dead serpent men to them in this hidden chamber. And then, you know, he seals this chamber, apparently with his sword, for all time. You know, now, I don't know how the sword does that. It might be that he's, you know, wedges it between the doors, you know, like a lock. But nobody can go in there anymore. And then, you know, Cole's going to rest. But, you know, the counselors, they want to let him get some medical attention, right, Billy? But Cole just walks away. You know, he says, I have wounds, but none of them are mortal. And then, you know, they say, when I recover, we'll go on the hunt. And Brule agrees. And Billy, this is a great ending, because as Cole walks away to his bedchamber to rest, the one counselor says, picked, should we not go after him? You know, because Cole is seriously wounded, right? I mean, he's been in a battle. Yeah. He's got sword slashes. He's got blood leaking from his wounds. But Brule says, nay, Greybeard, such a man as this is not so easily killed. Valka, but I see long rich years ahead for all Volusia, with such as Cull upon the Topaz throne.
I like that last panel too.
That is
showing Cole walking down the hallway there, Brule with his hand on the sword. It's awesome.
Oh, it's great, man. This is beautiful art. It's just stunning. So well done to the Severance, but also to Roy with the writing. He made it suitably. I mean, you kind of read through this issue, and it's you don't want to put it down and take a break, right, Billy? Not even a bathroom break, or you know, you want to finish it. It's so riveting the way Roy writes. From page to page, you just want to see what's going to happen next. And the art, of course, is a big part of that, because panel after panel of greatness, I would say, right, Billy? Wouldn't you say, from the Severance here?
Yeah, absolutely. They do books like this, you know, Sword and Sorcery and stuff like that, just incredibly well. It's, to me, it's what they did best, for sure. And then in the back, too, I don't know, your trade might not have this. Isn't that the letters pages? Because there's two letters pages, but at the bottom of the one page, there's a map of the Thurian continent in the time of King Cull, and it shows all the countries there in the map from before Atlantis sank, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't, in fact, have that, yeah. But I've seen that before in one of my other Cull comics, you know, believe the back issues I have of Cull. But, yeah, I know you filled up the run. But yeah, some of these early issues I don't have. Some of them I had before, but lost. But these very early ones I don't really own. I would love to, but you know, like I say, I'm not going to fill up my Conan and Cull runs because I've got them all in the Chronicles. So you know, it'll be like serious double dipping. But if it ever comes my way, I will pick it up. no question. So Billy, two great issues. I'm going to have to do the inevitable and ask you which one was your favorite between the Conan issue 2 and the Cull issue 2 as well.
Oh boy. Man, I guess if I had to pick one, I would probably go with probably Cull, just because it's a little crazier.
Yeah.
I just, you know, the Serpent Men to me are awesome. I love them. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot that comes down the road with them where, you know, Conan was more of a one-off.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm going to have to agree with you. I think the Cull issues, these early Cull issues are better than the Conan issues, you know, unfortunately. The Conan issues don't have much to criticize except for the fact that, you know, Barry Smith is still feeling his way around the character of Conan and the world of, you know, the Hyborian Age. Whereas I think, since Marie Severin and John Severin decided on a medieval setting, a medieval-like setting for Cull and Volusia, they were much more adept at drawing, you know, the world of Cull. Yeah, that's my only nitpick. But, you know, the Conan issue, fantastic issue. I loved it. But this the Cull issue is certainly my favorite as well, just because of the art and because of, like you say, the Serpent Men. And the craziness, plus there's this horror element that you and I love, right, Billy? And it's present in the Cull issue, but not at all in the Conan issue. So, Billy, I think that wraps it up for another Patreon episode for Radio Free Hyboria. But we hope you enjoyed it, listeners. We just want to end this episode by once again saying thanks for subscribing. And if you have any suggestions or comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send emails like you would normally do on our regular Into the Weird show, which is at sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. And of course, we'd love to mention your comments on subsequent episodes, and we'd also take them to heart, right, Billy, and make any improvements that you guys deem worthy. After all, without you, we wouldn't be here and we wouldn't have the Patreon. So thanks again for that, weirdos. I shouldn't call them that. Let's call them weirdlings from the Hyborian Age. Or from the Thurian Age, you know. It depends on your preference here. We're not going to be calling the show Radio Free Thuria anytime soon. But, you know, the way things have been going in these early issues, we might as well, right, Billy?
Yeah, really.
Anyway, so with that, listeners, we want to leave you with a little bit of a message. Wear your sandals when you tread those jeweled thrones beneath your feet. We don't know in which, you know, world you reside, but if it's in the podcasting realm, keep listening, and we'll do the same. You know, Billy, we'll keep focusing on what is best in life, and that is to hear the lamentations of our fellow podcasters. No, I shouldn't say that. but to at least hear our lamentations as we march through the Bronze Age here of the Hyborian Conan and the Thurian Kull. So with that, it's bye from me, Billy. Take care of yourself, listeners, until we meet again.
The gods forgot the secret of steel and left it on the battlefield. And we who found it are just men. Not gods, not giants, just men. And the secret of steel has always carried with it a mystery. You must learn its riddle, Conan. You must learn its discipline. For no one in this world can you trust. Not men, not women, not beasts. This you can trust.